Good morning and welcome to Community Voices. I'm John Wells. I'm here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peak. Our first guest this morning is Mark Porter, director of the Utah Nano Institute at the University of Utah. The Nano Institute is an organization where scientists of different disciplines work collaboratively on challenges in nanoscience and nanotechnology. What does this mean? Well, we're all going to have to stay tuned to learn more about this subject.
And good morning to you, John. Later in the show, our guest will be Scott Lilienfeld. He's the co-author with Sally Satal of the book Brainwashed, The Seductive Appeal of Mindless Neuroscience. In Brainwashed, psychiatrist Sally Satal and psychologist Scott Lilienfeld reveal how many of the real-world applications of human neuroscience gloss over its limitations and intricacies, at times obscuring rather than clarifying the myriad factors that shape our behavior and identities. Scott will be joining us on the phone to discuss this groundbreaking book. You're listening to Community Voices on KPCW right here in Park City, only in Park City, only on KPCW. We'll be right back after these messages.
This is Chris Robinson with Prudential Utah Real Estate, and we've been supporting KPCW since day one. Prudential Utah helps buyers and sellers with their home needs, whether it's a condo, single-family house, or undeveloped land. Our agents know our community and our local market. More information can be found at pru-utah.com.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
The first annual locally grown community market will be held on Saturdays from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. on Center Street in Oakley, Utah. The market will feature fresh produce, local artists, crafters, and jewelers. We will also have free kids' activities, live music, and great food. Take a ride to the other side and come visit us. The Locally Grown Community Market is a nonprofit organization.
And welcome back to Community Voices. Our first guest, Mark Porter, joins us in the KPCW studios. He is from the University of Utah. Mark is currently the USTAR Professor of Chemistry, Chemical Engineering, Bioengineering, and Pathology at the university, and he's the director of the Nano Institute of Utah. The institute enables Utah researchers from disciplines such as chemistry, physics, biology, engineering, medicine, and more to create collaborative teams to drive research, education, and commercialization of products in the fields of nanoscience. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Hi, everyone. How are you? It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. Mark, to the layperson, what is nanoscience and nanotechnology?
Well, there's a little bit of a historical story behind this first, is nano is not really new. It's been around, actually, for a long time. And it's really about the science, so the chemistry, the physics, the engineering, and materials that are on the order of, 10 to 100 nanometers. So to kind of ground you on length scales, a nanometer is about a thousandth to a ten thousandth the size of human hair. Another way to look at it is, remember an off-Earth picture of the Earth? You knock that down a million times, you get about to the size of a pencil. You go down another million, then now you're in the realm of nano. Yeah.
So wondering, Mark, I realized the stunning realization that I had no idea what nanotechnology was. You know, we hear these words as non-scientists, as lay people, and, you know, you hear them in the news, you hear about all these, you know, things that are coming up that nanotechnology and nanoscience is enabling us to do, but we really don't know what it is. You say nanotechnology has been around for longer than we think, but I had read that it wasn't until about 30 years ago that there was even a microscope that could detect something that small. So maybe talk a little bit about even the microscope that was invented. What kind of microscope does it take?
So what really gave rise to then the scientific discipline and engineering discipline of nano was really the development of this microscope. It's called the scanning tunneling microscope, and it was invented by folks at IBM. And it's really a tool that allows you to image atoms, molecules, objects this length scale without vacuum. You can do this in liquids and other kinds of things. And it's just a marvelous invention. The inventors won the Nobel Prize in Physics for this several years ago. Benning and Rohr, their names. They're from IBM in Europe. Anyway, the technology allows you, with an instrument that's about the size, really, of a coffee can, to image surfaces. And we use this technology in our laboratory and several other folks at the UDU, of course, as well. And you can see atoms. You can see molecules on surfaces. You can image proteins. And you can do this with an instrument now that costs, on the average, of maybe $50,000. So the microscopes that were in use then before had to be used in vacuum. They were called transmission electron microscopes. They cost millions of dollars. And you had to be a specialist, in fact, to run them. We have undergraduates on campus now that run these instruments and can basically see things at this length scale. So we actually now have a tool that you can use readily to begin to probe all these interesting phenomena. So it was really, that was the enabling technology that gave rise to what we talk about today as nanoscience.
So now every university has multiples of these types
Many. Salt Lake City Community College even has one of these instruments that they use in their classroom and teaches students. Yeah.
Okay.
You know, for many years, you always imagined, and it was true, that scientists, if it was an engineer, if it was a computer scientist, if it was a biologist or a chemist, they were doing their research sort of in a vacuum. They were off on their own working. And I'm fascinated by the fact that you have a collaboration, a huddling of these different disciplines, chemistry, physics, material science, computer science, and this has become an effective way to drive towards the solutions that you're driving towards. Can you talk about these collaborations?
Yeah, so really the way science and technology is today, each of the traditionally disciplines were isolated. Researchers were isolated. And many years ago, folks began to understand to really solve big science questions, you needed to form teams of folks who are experts in a diverse set of areas. So folks that have skill sets in one area, folks that have skill sets in a second area. And you would form these small working groups, these small teams that had a common theme, and the scientists would have commonality in their research interests. Form these teams, and this is the whole idea behind this, is this is really where discovery and breakthroughs happen.
And there is a payback to this. This is not just an academic research process. I mean, you're working towards products that can be commercialized, that can add value.
Absolutely. So, to take an example from the work that we do with my research group, we're involved in using nanotechnology and some of the phenomena that's been discovered at these length scales. So I should mention, nanotechnology is really about length scales that we haven't been able to look at carefully for a long time. So we're familiar with bulk materials. So gold has a nice yellow luster. Gold atoms in solution look a little bit yellow. But when you start to put 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 of these together, you start to see the properties of materials move from just their atomic scale to bulk materials. And with gold, for example, when a material is, say, a few hundred nanometers in size, if you change that diameter, say, go from 200 to 300 to 400, you actually change the color of the material. So that's really what we're trying to take advantage of, is this new phenomena, and we apply to my laboratory to try to develop tools to detect, to basically come up with diagnostic tests for early detection of disease and cancer. That's really what brought us to the university.
Wow. So talk about that a little bit. I mean, how did it start and how has that progressed you're doing?
We'd been doing some things, really trying to just develop new measurement tools. And one of the things that we had discovered was applying some of these gold nanoparticle materials where we could actually see very strong optical signals from these particles with just simply almost something like a little microscope. And the whole idea is if we could see these things at extremely low levels with a fairly easy tool to use to detect them, why not then harness this and try to develop into a new platform for diagnostic tests? So the idea is if we can detect things at lower and lower levels, such as markers of disease, we can potentially then diagnose and detect the presence of a disease earlier, and then patients can begin treatment, and then the chances for a positive outcome are in fact enhanced.
So wait, explain to me, So what you're saying is that the ability to break things down, say with gold, you can take the smallest particle of that matter of gold and use it to help diagnose, to create some diagnostic tests. Can you explain that to me in a way I might understand?
Sure. So, you know, the traditional approach for doing tests for human health would be to take a serum sample and then look for antibodies, basically the response of your body to that particular invader. What we do is we'll take a surface, put antibodies on the surface, expose that surface then to a serum sample. Then we'll take the gold nanoparticles that we'll put a coating on, and then we'll put a coating of another antibody on it, and we make something, called a sandwich. We sandwich the antigen or the target marker between two pieces of gold, so to speak. Then we shine light on it from a little laser, and we measure the signal from the gold particles. And it turns out we can see things at remarkably low levels. So when we talk about detection, we talk about limits of detection. So concentrations, you know, you think about, you know, water is something in molarity, 55 molar. So we talk about doing things on the order of 10 to the 20 times less than that. So we're talking about things below, when we talk about nanotechnology, we talk about doing things at nanomolar concentrations, things like this. And this would literally be, in some cases, we talk about numbers where we're looking for, say, 10 to 20 virus particles in a milliliter of liquid. So those are the kinds of things we're chasing. We're not there yet. We've got a lot of collaborations, and what drew us to the U were the School of Medicine, the Huntsman Cancer Institute, as well as university being just a top basic science and engineering school. That's what really brought us here, is a chance to join and become parts of these broader teams and to see how our mousetraps work.
Well, let's just talk about that for a moment. You are a USTAR professor, and the acronym USTAR stands for Utah Science, Technology, and Research. And I was taking a peek at some stuff that was online at the university, and more than 180 Utah companies have been founded on the University of Utah technologies over the last 20 years, and over 120 of those companies are prospering in Utah, including some pretty major players. So this is part of what attracted you to be the director of the Nano Institute.
Absolutely.
And what are some of the other applications besides cancer research that nanotechnology may be able to provide? I know the payback takes a while, but what are some of the other applications?
Yeah, we've got folks on campus chasing a lot of different things. We have folks looking at using nanotechnology to create new drug delivery vehicles. For example, early ways to treat cancer, the idea being there as opposed to chemotherapy, where you attack and affect the whole host, and we're all familiar with problems with chemotherapy. The idea is to coat nanoparticles, make them drug delivery vehicles so you can specifically target a tumor. So the only place that you attack in the body then is the tumor and not the entire host. So we have things in...
And how does nanotechnology enable you to actually target that tumor?
Well, it's a length scale type of thing. So it's really, you know, we're looking at trying to attack disease at the same length scale that the cells themselves are, or smaller than that.
Okay.
So we have a lot of different things in medicine. We have folks looking at nanotechnology related to solar energy. Also related to, solar energy, also environmental cleanup, a lot of different kinds of things like this.
And I believe there's an application for amputees where some nanotechnology devices, I believe, are attached to the amputee's stump and enables them to grow new tissue, or there's something
there's,
I read about there's, that.
There is a lot of work going on as well with these kinds of materials in terms of tissue regeneration. And so the whole idea there is, how do we make materials that are compatible with the human host and basically become compatible with the host before infection sets in? That's really the fight there.
Mark, I'm curious, before we go on with some of the other applications, I'm curious, maybe going back to John's question about, you know, being a scientist, you work in such isolation or in a vacuum, and you started off as a chemist, is that right? That's kind of your specialty. What did it take for you personally to, you know, sort of draw back from your isolation and then expand? I mean, it's fascinating to me that you all have done this, that you're combining so many sciences. And, you know, was it What was that process like for you personally as a chemist, as someone who just thinks about chemistry?
Well, that's a good question. That's a little bit difficult to answer. I think some of us are simply predisposed that way. You know, and I think in our particular case, we've been doing a lot of basic research. And it just kind of, as things evolve, you're like, wow, this is kind of interesting. And we ought to see if we could do something with it. And so doing things to try to, you know, for the betterment of humankind, that's infected a lot of us. I think, and I think some of the folks starting today, they get infected earlier than some of the older folks like me. It took me a few years. But yeah. Folks are, I think, a lot more conscious about actually not just doing science for science sake, but also chasing things and understanding where you can apply it. And to you, as an excellent track record in that regard.
Does it ever seem so big and overwhelming, all of these applications? I mean, you're going from drug delivery vehicles to, environmental cleanup to solar energy. Does it ever seem so infinite on such a grand scale that it's hard to fathom?
All the time. All the time. I think that's
good.
The easiest answer for that. It's it's exciting. It's overwhelming. I mean, it's why we get up and go to work early. You know, we work with students, and working with students, they keep us young.
Mm-hmm.
They always challenge us. They always question us. And so I think it's all of those kinds of things, I think, go with this.
And is the genesis for nanotechnology, does it start with someone in a particular field? Like, say I'm interested in solar energy, and I come up with an idea, like, wouldn't it be great if, you know, we did this? But, you know, say I'm an English major, so I have no idea how you would even, you know, I just dream up this creative idea, and then, you know, is that where the genesis is? We start with that, and I would approach the Nano Institute? Or does it start with someone like you who says, wouldn't it be great?
I think it's both ways. You know, there's a push, so there are folks that invent things, and then we begin to try to understand where it might be useful. And that's, of course, valuable. So blue sky research is, of course, valuable. And then there are also folks that have problems they want to solve, and they're basically look around and try to look for solutions. I teach a nanoscience class with several of my colleagues at the U. And interestingly, over the years, we've had students from Spanish, history, English, and religion.
Hmm.
So there are a lot of curious folks out there, and nano grabbed some of them.
You mentioned blue sky and blue sky research. And I wanted to ask you, how is the health of basic research at the university level today? I know years ago, Bell Labs in Murray Hill, New Jersey, they did basic research. Why is the sky blue? Why is that over there green? And they knocked out, on average, a patent per week. They weren't chasing profits. They weren't chasing products and money. And everybody today is, they just want to go out and they want to make money. And basic research is down a little bit. Is that starting to come back?
I think there's always a question. I should mention, I actually worked at Bell Labs for a few years. So
Were you in Murray Hill?
I was at Murray Hill. Yes. I was embedded in that institution for quite some time. And it was an exciting place. And you were simply, all they wanted to do at Murray Hill was to sit around and think, come up with ideas. And I think, you know, all these things have places. And I think blue sky research has got an important place in what we do. And also folks trying to understand what to do with it has an important place. And, you know, the pendulum swings back and forth. There'll be an emphasis more on blue sky research. And then folks are going to start to want to see what happens with it. And it'll, you know, so it'll swing a little bit that way. Then it'll swing back. So we certainly worry about blue sky research. We certainly worry about applications. And we certainly worry about the status of this, especially with the country's economy and things like this. And we do spend time worrying about it a good bit.
Basic research, though, when you think about it, out of Murray Hill, New Jersey, mm-hmm. the transistor, the laser beam. I mean, there were some things that have applications that have changed this world because people were just sitting around and thinking, creating the right environment and looking for breakthroughs. And well, we need more of that, I guess.
We do. And what we do at the U is designed the same way as Bell Labs. Bell Labs, your offices were in a separate hallway from your lab. So you had to walk a good bit to get to your lab. And you naturally ran into people and started talking about what to do. So there's a lot of elements in how things are being done at the university with USTAR and just the broad collaborative environment of the institution as a whole. and that's been existent for a long time. There's a lot of commonality or similarities between the two.
Mark, it's been during this show that it's been brought to light just what is done at the University of Utah. It's right down the road. Lots of our kids go to school there. I got my graduate degree there. You know, seems like a great state institution. I'm finding out bigger and better and just wild things that are done at the University of Utah, and this is one of them. How, you know, is the Nano Institute very unique? I mean, we're talking about Bell Labs and we're talking about the Nano Institute. Talk about where you are on a scale in comparison to other types of entities that do this.
Yeah, I think that, you know, the package at different institutions is different. The package that we have here, the integration, has both science and engineering campuses, you know, lots of strength there. But we're a bit unique, too, in the regards that we have a medical school and a cancer institute, the Huntsman Cancer Institute. So our brand is different than at lots of other institutions. There's a few other places that have some of these kinds of things, packages. Stanford does, for example. But we're fairly unique, and certainly in this part of the country, we're very unique in that we have that particular package. And that was one of the reasons that coming to the U. That was one of the draws.
Are there students coming there applying to just various departments, or can they apply to, you know, is there a major that would be called, you know, nanoscience?
We don't offer a major in nanoscience. Usually it comes from one of the home departments, so one of the stakeholder departments. So you would get students that work with me would get degrees, for example, in chemistry, chemical engineering, or bioengineering, and they would have a nanoscience bent to their research. So we've had discussions about whether there should be a major in that regard or not, but it's those are discussions that are going to take a lot of work through.
I wanted to mention that on October 18th, the 2013 Nano Utah Conference and Exhibition will be in Salt Lake City. Is that something that a layperson could attend and would find value from, or is that something for other types of folks?
I think it's a little bit of both. There are panel discussions and things like this at this conference, and those are the places, the venues where you could really kind of get more of a layperson's perspective of what's going on. And it's infectious because a lot of the presentations, the scientific presentations, are by students. And it is just a real blast to hear them get a chance to show up, stand up in front of folks and show off their wares.
What's the day in the life for the director of the Nano Institute?
Well, 3 or 4 cups of coffee in the morning. Check the baseball scores, you know, to see how my teams are doing. Not very well, by the way. And I'll get to work, you know, when the classes aren't in session, get to work, see what I've got to do for the day, talk with students, and puzzle over problems.
And how much of your time goes into chasing funding?
Oh, probably more than any of us would like to. I probably spend 20% of my time working on that.
Okay.
Yeah.
And do you interface with the venture capital community at all in Utah?
We have a little bit. We're actually just starting to make some headway with some technology that is from the U to try to move into some of that. We'd surely like to talk to people, though.
Mark, I have a final question. As you've been talking, I don't know a lot about alchemy, but nanoscience sounds like alchemy to me. And that's, you know, but that's more of a philosophical sort of science. Can you compare the two?
Well,
and maybe give me a definition of alchemy.
Well, I do think about it this way. You know, sometimes some of the things that we do would really be science and engineering. There's a bit of a formula, you know, a menu to try to follow. But there's a lot of things we do that are much more alchemy. Sometimes we think about what we do really as art and not science. Because it's really about, and sometimes it's, for example, about the experiment that didn't work. Because that's the interesting one.
Right.
The outcome is not what it should be. And then we look at it and decide, well, should I worry about it? And sometimes we'll chase down those paths.
We'd like to thank Mark Porter, director of the Nano Institute, for joining us this morning in this fascinating conversation. 30 minutes down the road is an incredible facility where a lot of strange things go on that have application to all of us. Here in Park City and to our greater world. So just a fascinating conversation. Thanks for joining us this morning.
I enjoyed it, and come on down and visit anytime you'd like.
Thank you. It's been nice having you. Fascinating. Now John and I are going to become nanoscience experts, right?
Oh, yeah.
And this is Community Voices here on KPCW. stay with us. We'll be back with Scott Lilienfeld. He's a co-author, along with Sally Satel, of the book Brainwashed, The Seductive Appeal of Mindless Neuroscience, some more interesting and cool science. And right now I'm going to air this week's Park City History Bits. Here you go.
Besides bars and bordellos, what did local residents do for entertainment when Park City was just starting out? This is Hope Woodside with your weekly Park City History Bit. Long before there was Sundance, Parkites enjoyed the theater. By 1880, vaudeville jugglers, singers, and animal acts entertained at the Park Opera House on Main Street. Silent movies played in five different theaters on Main Street, including the Egyptian Theater. The Egyptian opened in 1926 and played off America's new fascination with all things Egyptian that was spurred by the discovery of King Tut's tomb. The beautiful Grand Opera House was built in 1897, but sadly burned down 3 months after its grand opening in the Great Fire of 1898 and was never rebuilt.
This Park City History Bit is brought to you by the Park City Museum, where you can explore Park City history every day on Main Street. Sponsored by Julie Hopkins of Keller Williams Real Estate.
What's the buzz? Tell me what's the happen.
Summer's here!
Shh! Summer's where? Wait, Jan, it's here? Uh-oh, don't tell anybody about Park City's summer secrets.
It's a secret? But John, isn't that our job, telling Park City who's got savory summer snacks and where the sizzle and fun is?
Secrets out for summer. Find out what all the cool kids are up to this summer. Tune in to Fun Friday at 9 a.m.
Brought to you by the Summit County Fair,
All Seasons Adventures,
Park Silly Sunday Market,
Zermatt Resort and Spa,
and the Homestead Resort.
350 Main Brasserie is pleased to support KPCW. 350 Main is located in the historic Golden Rule Building at 350 Main Street and serves Chef Carl Fiesinger's Low Country Cuisine nightly at 5:30 p.m. You can contact us at 649-3140. Our website is 350main.com with reservation, menu, and contact information.
Welcome back to Community Voices. I'm Lynn Ware-Peek here with my co-host, John Wells. Well, we were just talking with Mark Porter from the Nano Institute at the University of Utah. Really fascinating subject and kind of a launch pad for learning more about nanoscience. We hope that we got it down to the layperson's terms, and we hope to do that with our next guest, who's going to be a lot of fun to talk to. We've got him on the phone right now. He's Scott Lilienfeld. He co-authored a book called Brainwashed, The Seductive Appeal of Mindless Neuroscience. What can't neuroscience tell us about ourselves? Well, since functional MRI, functional magnetic resonance imaging, which is a functional MRI, was introduced in the early 1990s, brain scans have been used to help politicians understand and manipulate voters, to determine guilt in court cases, and to make sense of, well, just about everything from musical aptitude to romantic love. But although brain scans and other neurotechnologies have provided groundbreaking insights into the workings of the human brain, the increasingly fashionable idea that they are the most important means of answering the enduring mysteries of psychology is, well, misguided. At least that's what our next guest says, and even potentially dangerous. Scott Lilienfeld is joining us by phone. And Scott, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, first of all, let's take a look at what neuroscience is and how the field came about, how it was developed, and what are some of the things that, I suppose, what's the mass appeal of neuroscience?
Right. Well, so neuroscience itself is a gigantic field, and we really only tackle a very small and modest slice of it, but a slice that maybe is the best known to the general public, which is neuroimaging or brain imaging. So that that really came of life in the 1980s, 1990s, especially with functional magnetic resonance imaging. Before that, PET scanning, positron emission tomography scanning, and so on. And it's that's probably the part that the public knows, although it's probably only a minority of what academics do. But it's it has really shaped the public conception of the brain probably more than any other technology, partly because it's pretty. It produces lots of very interesting and dramatic images, and we've all seen these very dramatic images of the brain that seem to show different areas lit up. And I think they're informative to a degree, and they tell us some interesting things, but they're also very prone to be misunderstood, as you pointed out.
Right. So now we've used MRIs, say, you know, I'm out skiing at here in Park City. I bump my head. I'm taken down to the university hospital for an MRI to find out, to diagnose injury or disease. But at what point did this become sort of a function of psychology, I guess I would want to say, is...
Right.
Is,
it's a great question. So what you're talking about there is actually not too controversial. It's not one that we have any particular problem with. What you're talking about there, to get a bit technical, is what is called structural MRI, which is looking at the brain structure, how it kind of entered more into the field of psychology. Psychologists sometimes use structural MRI too, but the primary tool that we look at and that is most relevant to psychology is functional MRI, which is looking at the function of the brain, looking at the brain as it's actually in action, as it's actually responding to different stimuli, for example, that psychologists might present, like emotional stimuli or various stimuli involving words or pictures or things like that, that are supposed to provide researchers with an understanding of how the brain actually reacts in something close to real time.
Right. So they've got a brain scan going on me. They bring in a plate of dark chocolate with almonds. They monitor what my brain does when I first see it. Then they monitor again what my brain does when I take that first bite.
That's exactly right.
Okay. And what has been sort of the most popular place that we've seen this type of neuroscience surface?
I think one area that's become very popular is what is sometimes perhaps a little harshly called blobology, kind of this idea of trying to find different blobs in the brain that become activated in response to different stimuli. So you mentioned chocolate. Well, the media might even refer to things like a chocolate center in the brain or a God center in the brain or a music center in the brain. Thoughtful neuroscientists, and I would say the majority of neuroscientists out there, 95% of them, are thoughtful and are well aware that that's a gross oversimplification. There's no simple chocolate center or God center or music center. But the media sometimes makes the mistake of portraying brain images that way, functional images that way. And that, I think, can lead to all kinds of mischief and misunderstanding on the part of the general public.
So I think, as you mentioned in the book, most neural real estate is zoned for mixed-use development. So just knowing that the lust of chocolate would light up your insula or a certain part of your brain doesn't mean that that's where all the lust is. It's mixed uses, I think you said.
That's exactly right. And the problem, again, to use a bit of a technical term here, the problem is what's called reverse inference, and it sounds like a very technical term, but it's actually not that complicated. That's the risky strategy that we sometimes engage in when we are interpreting and sometimes misinterpreting brain images. That is, we see activation in a particular brain area, and then we try to make a reverse inference and then conclude what must have the person been thinking or feeling when they showed that pattern of activation. The reason that is a risky strategy, very often wrong, although it's been used very often by the media and sometimes by neuromarketers, people who try to infer what people are feeling when they look at product, is exactly the problem you're talking about. It's very, very rare, arguably non-existent, for one brain area to be experiencing or to be tied to the experience of one emotion, one thought, and one emotion, one thought only.
And as you mentioned in the book, Frito-Lay wanted to sell some potato chips to women, so it commissioned the neuroimaging study, which found that women looking at a shiny bag of chips had increased activity in this particular part of the cortex. And in hopes of boosting sales, Frito-Lay switched to these matte bags versus shiny bags.
Mm-hmm.
As a result of that, that went bust. How many other big companies have been sucked into neuroimaging studies?
There have been lots of them. There's a whole new, I don't know the exact number, but there's a whole new field of neuroentrepreneurship, neuromarketing that tries to do exactly that. And it actually, I think, as we point on the book, it may have some potential. It may have some promise. It's not inherently wrong. I think the problems there are many, though. I think one of them is the one you mentioned, that one can maybe make some good guesses, some good hypotheses about what people might be experiencing when they show brain activation, but one can only use that as one potential source of information. And I think we run into all kinds of trouble when we try to draw strong conclusions from it. So that's one big problem. Another big problem is that we don't really know for sure whether or not these images tell us anything above and beyond what one could get from just talking to the person. So there are a few studies that suggest that brain images might sometimes give us some additional information, but in fact, the evidence that they do is at this point surprisingly feeble. So it could very well be that we're going to do just as well, if not better, just by asking people whether they like product, what they're experiencing when they look at something. Do they experience pleasure, fear, disgust, what have you? The idea is that brain images are going to somehow get beneath the radar. They're going to be kind of stealth weapons and tell us something that the person is not aware of. That's possible, and one wouldn't rule that out, but we're not really anywhere near at that point yet.
Well, selling potato chips is one thing, going to jail is another. I mean, this neurocentric worldview is sort of crept into law enforcement and criminal justice. Defense attorneys trying to use brain scans to prove that their clients lack impulse control, therefore they can't be legally responsible. What's going on there?
So that's another great question. So you're exactly right. There's more and more interest in introducing brain images, especially functional brain images, but maybe structural images too, into the courtroom. And at this point, it's still very much in its infancy. But we in the book, express some worries about that. It's often very hard to interpret what those images mean. And there's concern, although admittedly the research here is a bit mixed, but there's some concern that presenting jurors and other triers of fact with brain images, and particularly with brain-based explanations, might end up distorting or warping their reasoning. Because after all, those images might carry a kind of cachet of respectability, a kind of scientific respectability that isn't always deserved. So it's not always clear that merely because someone shows a deficit, say in functional imaging, in certain brain areas linked to impulse control, like the frontal parts of the brain, the parts of the brain right behind our eyes, which are often the parts that are most linked to impulse control, it's not entirely clear what that tells us above and beyond what we already know, namely the person has poor impulse control.
Yeah.
But somehow the fact that we see it on a brain image may somehow carry more weight than it needs. I think the other big issue here is, and this is more philosophical, is what do you make of that? So if someone, for example, shows deficits in the frontal cortex, which we know tend to be linked to impulse control on a brain scan, does that mean we should let the person go or give the person a lighter penalty? Well, maybe. On the other hand, one could make the opposite argument, and some people have. Some people could actually say, no, it actually should help the prosecution, because
right.
after all, it shows that, in fact, the person does have poor impulse control, and that might not be the person we want on the street. So its interpretation is a lot more complicated, I think, than people often recognize.
And Scott, since your book has been released, there's been a tremendous amount of buzz about your book. A lot of people are really getting behind it. So let me ask you, have you been asked to testify for the prosecution in any of these cases, or has your book been cited as evidence against any claims like my frontal cortex made me do it?
Right. So the answer to both of those is no. I've not been asked yet, although it may be a matter of time. I do suspect that our book just came out about a month and a half ago, so it's probably a little too early for it to be cited, but it may be cited in that regard. And admittedly, I don't want to imply that there's never any room for brain imaging in the courtroom. I do think that it can sometimes provide converging evidence along with behavioral evidence. I think if a good clinical interview by a well-trained psychologist or psychiatrist suggests the person has poor impulse control, but we want some more information to corroborate that, and the brain imaging data also corroborate that information, provide a little bit more heft to that claim, I don't have a particular problem with it. Where I do have a problem is introducing it as a source of evidence that's somehow intended to be definitive or somehow inherently more informative than behavioral information.
Now, Scott, just yesterday, and John wasn't with me on this interview, but I spoke to David McRaney. He came out with a new book called You Are Now Less Dumb. And he talks about how we succumb to self-delusion and irrational thinking about why we do the things that we do. And his argument is, it's funny, it's in part humor, but it's, kind of pop psychology mixed in with all this scientific research that says, well, you know, we might think we're doing it because of this, but really it's just our brain, you know, reacting. So he's almost arguing the opposite of what you're saying. And I think what the conclusion that I draw from it is that brain scans are valid and useful, and the application of science to psychology is very useful. But what I hear you saying is, when it comes right down to it, we can draw the same conclusions from just psychology.
Well, that's right. Admittedly, I haven't read McCrae's book. I believe I read his previous book, I think.
Right. You Are Not So Smart.
Not Survivor, which is good. I like that book a lot. Unsolicited endorsement. I don't know him, but it was a good and fun book to read, so I look forward to reading his new book, which I did not know about. But at some level, of course, he's right. At some level, I think virtually all neuroscientists and all psychologists, ourselves included, my co-author, Sai Satel, feels this way. At some level, we believe all of it is traceable somewhere to brain activity, so we don't think there's this immaterial soul floating around in there. It's possible, but we certainly don't think that soul, whatever, even if there is one, accounts for those kinds of behaviors. So at some level, all of this is traceable to brain activity. There's no question about it. But the question is it necessarily the most useful level of analysis, the most useful level of explanation, for example, for understanding biases? And I'm not sure at this point it is. It could be one day, but right now it could very well be that we understand our biases, understand our distortions just as well, if not better, by resorting to the psychological level of analysis, the level of motives, the level of defenses, the level of thoughts, and so on, which is often the most helpful level of analysis for understanding why we're all biased in our thinking.
Right. So after yesterday's interview, I felt like my personal accountability just went out the window. I mean, I can't help it. And I was so relieved. Now I'm thinking the opposite. I got to take back that accountability for whatever it is I do. But I wanted to ask you about some of the biggest mistakes that neuroscience has led us to. I mean, you know, we talk about Google and Facebook and, you know, politicians using this to try to influence voters and all kinds of stuff. What are the biggest bloops, mistakes?
Yeah, well, there are lots. It's hard to keep track of them, right, because there's so many of them. So I think that I think all the things you talk about are very premature, and I think those are serious mistakes. I think more broadly, I think a big mistake that we as a field have made, and I say this in my own field of psychology, is again assuming that the brain level of analysis is always the most important. So, for example, addiction. So are addictions brain diseases? Well, at some level, of course, they are. There's no question about it. Obviously, addiction at some level stems from the brain, and we know that there are genetic susceptibilities to some types of addiction, and we also know that severe substance abuse can sometimes damage the brain. So there's a core of truth in this idea that addiction is a brain disease, but by the same token, viewing it only as a brain disease, which I think increasingly our field has sometimes done, I think is a big blooper. It's a big mistake, and I think it's an important one, maybe more important than using brain imaging for neuromarketing and so on, which can obviously have some bad consequences. But these false beliefs, I think, can have very detrimental consequences because they can lead us down the wrong road when it comes to intervention. So I think as a field, we've sometimes made the mistake of assuming because addictions are partly rooted in the brain, which of course they are, therefore the most effective intervention is necessarily biological, that we have to find a drug, for example, to prevent addiction, and it could be those are helpful to some extent, but we also know from a lot of data that behavioral techniques that reward addicts for staying off drugs, for example, and give them better coping skills for dealing with stress are just as effective, probably more effective in the long run. And I think we have to be very careful about sort of this brain disease model of many disorders. Again, all mental disorders are at some level brain diseases, no question about that, so there's some truth in it. But there's also a danger there that we're going to forget about the behavioral and psychological level of analysis, which for some disorders, not all, but for some disorders, may often be the most effective in the long run for treatment.
Scott, 5 days ago, a report, an article in the New York Times came out saying, and I believe it's going to actually be published in the Mayo Clinic proceedings in the August issue, that more than 40% of established practices, medical practices that were studied were found to be ineffective or harmful and 38% beneficial and 22% unknown. And a lot of these are new practices, new procedures. Are we pushing the technology too quickly, or are there too many people trying to make money here? What do you think is going on as you step back and look at everything that's happening in medicine?
Well, yeah, I say this as a vivid outsider because I'm not a physician, but I do know that work, and I suspect, I can't vouch for the exact numbers, but I suspect it's probably, the big picture, I think, is probably true. I don't think we're pushing the technology too far in most domains. No, I don't think that's the problem. I think the problem is one of premature excitement and premature claims, which I'm reluctant to blame medicine for that because we see the same thing in many scientific fields. In psychology, we certainly see that as well. I think we see a culture sometimes in academia where people understandably are reinforced and rewarded for exciting new findings and breakthroughs. But we have to remember that we should not typically trust new findings, especially dramatic new breakthroughs, until they have been replicated, which is kind of a fancy word for repeated, replicated by independent investigators. And I think as a field, medicine and psychology, and I think we're coming to realize this, have often not valued replication nearly enough. And I think that's understandable because replications are not typically very exciting. If someone else has found a dramatic new thing, that person gets all the fame and the glory. The other investigators who then spend time trying to see if they can get the same thing in their labs oftentimes don't get a lot of fame and success. It's not nearly as sexy a finding. It's not going to make the front page news. But in some ways, those replications by other investigators are more important in many ways than the initial findings. And we should especially bear in mind that when something is a breakthrough, when something is very exciting, one thing that makes it exciting is that it is new, that it runs counter to what we know or we thought we knew before, and those are often the very findings that are the least likely to replicate. So to me, it's not a matter of pushing the technology too far. It's a matter of being a little more cautious, a little more circumspect in our claims until other investigators have checked out our findings.
Our guest is Scott Lilienfeld. He's the co-author of the new book, Brainwashed, The Seductive Appeal of Mindless Neuroscience.
And back to replication and being more cautious. I mean, anybody can grab a soapbox with a title and a crisp presentation and tell a story. And that's where the danger comes in. I mean, I don't know if this guy's good or not, but I was flipping through the channels one night, and this guy, Daniel Amen, was on the PBS show with some sort of presentation about change your brain, change your body. And he's showing all these blobs of colors in the brains lighting up and all these other different things. And it's not that simple, is it?
No, and we do mention Amen briefly in the book. He's been certainly widely criticized for making claims that go beyond the evidence. I think time will tell to see whether he's right or not. But I think, again, the watchword should be caution. The watchword should be humility. So often in the field of medicine and in the area of medicine, I know best psychiatry, which I think is a wonderful discipline. I think it's taken some unfair knocks of late, but I think psychiatry is wonderful and there's some great stuff in there. But by the same token, one thing we've learned from the history of psychiatry the hard way is that many, many well-intentioned people made very expansive claims about interventions that work, whether they were prefrontal lobotomy, which a lot of good people thought worked. People forget that 19 1949, someone won the Nobel Prize for promoting prefrontal lobotomy. People were sure it worked. Insulin coma therapy, a lot of medications that people thought were effective or miracle cures have turned out not to be the case. That doesn't mean we shouldn't have hope, and it just means we shouldn't have false hopes. There's a lot of promise out there, but we have to be a little more cautious sometimes, a little more circumspect, and sometimes, which is hard, especially when you have people suffering from terrible illnesses, patients, which is easier said than done. But ultimately, that's what we need more of.
Well, that's the target for the charlatan. I mean, again, you get the soapbox and you get the fancy title and you bring in the people that are suffering and you tell them a story. And next thing you know, you're selling them supplements and a plan of practice that's putting money in that person's pocket and not necessarily helping the person that got involved in the scheme.
And right, and I don't blame the people who fall prey to these practices in the least. When you're vulnerable and you're desperate, which many, many good people are, they're going to, of course, try to find something that's helpful. Who can blame them if they are sick or a loved one is sick? But the people who promote these practices, sometimes they are charlatans, no doubt. Sometimes they are sincere, well-meaning people who have been deluded, who are sure that their technique works. But one thing we've learned, again, through the history of science, although it was not really until the 1890s or so that this became widely realized, is that we need to have controlled studies to see whether or not techniques work. Because so often people make the mistake of assuming that if they take a pill or they undergo an intervention and they get better afterwards, that the pill or intervention must have been what was effective. But that's not necessarily the case. There are dozens of reasons why people can get better after intervention that has nothing to do with the intervention itself.
Scott, I'm sitting here thinking about how our society, you know, we're trendy folk. We go for trends. And if you equate kind of what we've been talking about for the last half hour to our diet, for example, you know, for a while it's all no fat and then it's no carbs and then it's no gluten. And you know, it comes back to that everything in moderation, really. And this is kind of what you're saying in your book, isn't it? I mean, taking a little bit of everything.
Right. And when it comes to diets, again, I'm no expert, but I know enough to know that, because I know some people are experts, there ain't no quick fix. I mean, people have tried and have looked at all kinds of crash diets and quick fix diets, and they don't work very well because we know most people regain the weight that they initially lost. So there's no simple solution here. There are solutions, of course, but they're often the unpleasant ones. They're not the quick fixes. When it comes to diets, the solutions are long-term lifestyle changes, which are often not the answers we want to hear.
That's right. So take all of this that we've been talking about and what you have learned, apply a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and just don't go overboard on the latest development is the bottom line.
Right. In other words, listen to the claims, be open-minded, but be skeptical too. Insist on evidence and insist on independent replication by other investigators, and make sure these are claims that other investigators, good investigators, have been able to repeat as well.
The book is Brainwashed, The Seductive Appeal of Mindless Neuroscience. And Scott Lilienfeld, thank you so much for your time today. It's a fascinating subject.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right. Take care. And this is Community Voices, only on KPCW, only in Park City, and we'll be right back.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery. For 30 years, we know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com. VaultHomeLoans.com. Purchase and refinance mortgages. Conventional FHA and VA, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Thanks for listening to Community Voices. I'm Lynn Ware-Peek here with my co-host, John Wells. We'd like to thank our guest, Mark Porter from the Nano Institute at the University of Utah. Also, Scott Lilienfeld, who co-authored Brainwash, The Seductive Appeal of Mindless Neuroscience. And of course, our sponsor, San Francisco Designs, Albion Financial, Prudential Utah Real Estate, 350 Main and the Spur, and Zions Bank. This is KPCW Park City.